Good afternoon and welcome to the City View podcast. Me, Andy Sylvester, the editor here at City AM, on what is turning into a lovely sunny afternoon in the Square Mile. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Interactive Investor's Victoria Scholar, who will whistle through a whole host of global market moves, as well as some of the more eye-catching corporate updates with me today. And before that, I'll be joined by City AM's own Charlie Conchi to have a quick chat about the Queen's speech and what it might tell us about the government's priorities, both in the city and for the economy at large. First, though, the corporate news and a new, somewhat surprising voice adding to calls for a windfall tax on energy companies. John Allen, the chairman of Tesco, on the radio this morning saying firms would be expecting it. Here's what he told the Today programme.
Than it is with food. And I think there's an overwhelming case for a windfall tax on profits from those in energy producers fed back to those most in need of help with energy prices. I think that would be the single biggest thing could be done.
You know, the argument against that is that it might deter companies from investing in sources of energy.
I think they are expecting it, and I doubt they would actually be much fazed by it.
Calls will no doubt increase off the back of British gas owner Centrica's update this morning, telling markets it expects to post annual earnings at the top of its targets. The company said it had been boosted by strong, quote-unquote, volumes across its nuclear and gas production operations, while its trading business has also increased volumes of gas and renewable energy trading to improve UK supply amid pressure after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That update, of course, following reports of record underlying profits in the latest quarterlies from energy giants BP and Shell. Labour jumping all over calls for a windfall tax this morning, as you probably expect. But the fundamental point remains, for me at least, that countries that embark on arbitrary, unexpected, and certainly politically advantageous tax raids do not traditionally find favour with global investors or firms. And that's before you get to the fact that those energy companies who are having a very good 2022 had a pretty miserable 2020 and 2021. Elsewhere, an official arbitration committee has rejected Unite the Union's bid to become recognised as the official union at the Financial Conduct Authority. Unite had applied to become recognised as the official union for the sake of collective bargaining amid a pay row. But this morning, the Central Arbitration Committee ruled the bid was not quote-unquote admissible. The decision comes after months of wrangling over terms and conditions changes at the regulator, with routine payments labelled as bonuses scrapped in favour of performance-based pay grades. Unite then requested recognition by the FCA last year, a claim the watchdog said should instead be settled by the authority. The CAC this morning saying that they did not believe that a majority of workers within the bargaining unit would be likely to favour recognition of the union, perhaps bringing to an end the industrial unrest over at the regulator. The FCA, for their part, saying they're open to consultation, they're open for discussion, but keen to point out too that the average employee at the regulator will see a pay rise of some 12% over the next 2 years. Elsewhere, Heathrow has posted strong results for April, but continue to warn about the uncertainties looming ahead. The London hub reported 5 million passengers travelling through its terminals in April, outbound leisure travel driving much of the demand, prompting the airport to increase its passenger forecast for the year by some 16%. Despite that good news, the airport still warning that a combination of the war in Ukraine, higher fuel and inflation rates, as well as COVID restrictions in some key Asian markets, continue to create uncertainty. We all want to see travel get back to pre-pandemic levels as quickly as possible, said Chief Exec John Holland Kay, but alas, we have to be realistic. Those numbers will be interesting, say the least, to Virgin Atlantic bosses, who last week suggested that Heathrow was downplaying its recovery in order to justify higher passenger fees. Another good old-fashioned spat. Now we'll move to the away from the corporate news, really, to the Queen's speech and the wider economic and political picture, joined by Charlie Conchi, who had the pleasure, if that's the right word, of sitting through the Queen's speech earlier today, along with much of the rest of the newsroom. Charlie, the Queen's speech, chance for government to lay out its programme of legislation for the next year or thereabouts. Often a little light on detail. Essentially, the government writes a speech for usually the Queen, Prince Charles today, to read out and give a sense of what is on the cards. We obviously already have the manifesto, but this is sort of an updated yearly manifesto. I think people were perhaps hoping for a bit more meat on the bones this year because of the economic situation we're in terms of what government might be doing in the near term to deal with cost of living, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's fair to say it remained a fairly standard Queen's speech and one that an awful lot of people have sort of sat this afternoon saying, well, I'm frankly none the wiser about what the plan is.
Yeah, exactly. I think this was always going to be read very much as a sort of attempted reset moment after the pretty torrid period the government has had in recent weeks, just on the back of the disastrous set of local elections as well. And unsurprisingly, we sort of see the whole kind of agenda framed around alleviating that big crisis of the cost of living. I think there was an interesting sort of emphasis on growing the economy to deliver that. So we saw big emphasis on things like levelling up agenda, scrapping EU legislation, boosting energy security. But as you said, it's the kind of devil's in the detail. And even time-wise, this was a shorter Queen's speech than normal. So still very much, you know, lots of flesh to be put on the bone, despite a sort of swathe of new and, well, existing commitments as well.
Yeah, indeed. An awful lot of it had already been sort of suggested before. Let's have a quick look at two of them specifically relevant, I guess, to us more generally. The energy bill, I should point out the choreography of this is that the Prince Charles, in today's case, does his speech, gives the outline, and then we all get sent a document, 140-odd pages, which has now finally gone up on the government website, which gives us a bit more detail. And the energy bill, all about that domestic supply. But again, it didn't really build on what we'd been expecting.
Yeah, exactly. As with much of it, there was a lot of sort of previously announced detail, and there was an emphasis on kind of building on the success of the COP26 summit, as Prince Charles and the government put it. I think I saw a few different reactions of Prince Charles wincing as he was having to deliver this particular section of the commitment. But again, it was sort of a focus on really delivering what has been set out in the energy security strategy, which government announced last month. So I think as we do see a bit more detail in this, it's going to be really focused on sort of, you know, reducing reliance on Kremlin-backed fossil fuels and announcing plans to sort of phase out Russian coal and oil imports. That is what we can expect. But as you said, yeah, it's still lots to come.
Yeah, which says something about the state of our debate on the energy market. I suppose it's a bit much to ask for them to turn the entire energy market around in 12 months when the situation we've got ourselves into now is a result of really decades of policy. On financial services and illicit money, just quickly, a couple of bills floated today. Financial services seem to me to be predominantly around ripping up EU regulation or perhaps making it slightly more flexible for British financial firms. Low on detail. More detail, I think it's fair to say, around illicit money and money laundering, clearly in the news as a result of Russian, you know, aggression in Ukraine and Russian money flowing through London and the links drawn between the two. On the financial services side of things, seemed to me that it's been given a pretty warmish welcome, I suppose, from the city. But again, 18 months ago, Rishi Sunak sat down with me on this very podcast and said we were set for Big Bang 2.0 and we were going to try and do interesting things with regulation. You know a bit, obviously, around solvency too, that these things are happening slowly, but there will become a point when the square mile starts to hear benefits of Brexit, opportunities of the EU exit, ripping up regulation and saying, well, it's been a few years. Where's the, show me the money, to borrow Jeremy Guire's phrase.
Yeah, exactly. I think bonfire of regulation is another thing we've heard sort of banged out every kind of few weeks over the last year or so. And like you said, there has been some movement on things like Solvency II, and I think that will probably be top of the agenda when it does come to reforming those EU rules and scrapping EU rules. I think capital markets reform will be another area that will sort of be under that bill, looking to sort of boost the profile of London's capital markets as a place to kind of float and that sort of thing. But again, you know, much more to come, and I'll keep making that point. It'll get rather tiresome, but
I mean, you're right, because I mean, the thing with financial services reform in particular and regulatory reform post Brexit is that the government has two very clear roadmaps that it has endorsed in the Hill review around listings and also the Khalifa review when it comes to fintech. The question will be how quickly those can be implemented and how quickly they can be felt in the economic figures, because this is a political government. It is explicitly a political government, and they will want to see some progress, you would have thought, by the time the next election rolls around. Anyway, much to discuss at length. There'll be more in-depth analysis tomorrow in City AM. But for now, Charlie, thank you so much. Now I'm joined by Victoria Scholar again from Interactive Investors. Victoria, always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's great to be back.
Why don't we talk about what is increasingly one of the world's most unpredictable but also less thrill-seeking roller coasters, which is global markets. Yesterday a down day, today very much an up day. What's going on? Talk us through global markets right now, because it was a huge sell-off yesterday, and yet apparently everybody's woken up in a much better mood today.
Yeah, there does seem to be some sort of optimism that's been instilled into markets today. I'm not quite sure the reasoning why, given the huge sell-off that we saw yesterday. Perhaps there's just a sense that after that three-day bloodbath, things were a bit overdone. But essentially, we're seeing European markets regain ground, and it was the tech sector that was hit hardest yesterday. That's leading the gains today. And it's the DAX and the CAC on the continent that are really leading the charge, with the FTSE 100 staging slightly more tempered gains. But yesterday's sell-off was extremely intense. We saw the NASDAQ down by over 4% and the S&P 500 hitting over one-year lows, in an extension of that negativity that we saw last week. And there were some stocks that were hit particularly hard, like Tesla down over 9% and Uber down by over 11.5%. So it feels as though that sort of post-Fed bullish mood that we had for a brief period on Wednesday evening was quickly overpowered by this sense of nervousness propelling those huge declines over the last three sessions. But we are seeing a little bit of a bounce back today. Where we go from here is really, really yet to be seen. But there is a sense that there is likely to be more selling, and we're not at the trough yet.
No, it doesn't seem like there's tremendous amounts of good news around. There are sort of rational things you can do in response to central bank guidance and statements, of course, but fundamentally, every bit of economic news that I hear pelted around news conference in the morning does not exactly scream things are at the bottom. It seems like things could get much worse, and obviously that's affecting the mood both here and on Wall Street, and of course in Asia, still dealing with the delights of zero COVID. Speaking of sort of global market moves, the US dollar is now at an almost two-decade high, may even be at a two-decade high. What's driving that at the moment? Because it's, I say this as somebody who's going on holiday to New York in 6 weeks. So talk me through what's going on. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad I bought my hotel a couple of weeks ago. Talk me through the US dollar and what's driving that, because it's linked very much to the oil price, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we're actually seeing the US dollar hit sort of 20-year highs. And there tends to be that inverse correlation between the greenback and what we see in commodity markets. And that was particularly stark yesterday, with oil prices down by nearly 6% and the US dollar marching higher. I think that it's sort of driven by two factors. Firstly, it's the prospect of monetary tightening. You know, at first, it was the Bank of England that was leading the pack at the end of last year. And that's when we saw that brief rally in the pound. Now that the Fed is very much looking at double rate hikes, even talk of triple rate hikes or 75 basis point hikes, that's really supporting the US dollar. And then there is this overall sense of nervousness and the volatility that we've seen. The VIX index, for example, are surging by about 100% since the January lows. So that risk-off sentiment means that investors are looking for safe havens. So it feels as though it's a real flight to safety trade that's driving the greenback sharply higher.
Yeah, and that VIX index you discussed is basically a measurement of how nervous Wall Street traders are, right? That's what it exists to do.
Yeah, so it's sort of known as the Wall Street Fear Index. And as market volatility picks up, or as we see sharp movements, typically towards the downside, because sharp movements tend to be on the way down, we see markets sort of trickle higher. So when we see volatility spike, that tends to be an indication that there's a lot of nervousness and there's a lot of bearishness as well.
I don't think that's going away for now. At least it is a roller coaster. I was talking in the office last week that someone compared stock markets to being a sort of fairground ride. And the only one I could think of from the start of the year, at least, particularly with regard to tech stocks, was that it looked a bit like a log flume and you never really knew where the bottom was. So a roller coaster, I suppose, at least has some ups. Yeah, I'm not a massive fan myself, certainly not when money's at stake. From the global to the very local, a battle between in the UK, a battle between two corporate giants, one in Bradford, one in Blackburn, over the future of McColl's. Now, obviously, Morrison's secured the purchase in the end. Talk us through sort of what happened over the weekend, and I guess what Morrison's plan to do with McColl's, because they've saved it. It's a decent sort of estate, 16,000 employees. It was a very swift purchase, but presumably the logic for Morrison's is there, right?
Yeah, I think that it is a strategic fit for Morrisons to acquire this insolvent convenience store chain. It's going to be taking on its 1,160 shops, and it's also going to inherit its 2,000 member pension scheme. So that's alleviated some of the fears from McColl's employees about store closures and job cuts. But in terms of the fit, Morrisons already works very closely with McColl's. It's a key wholesale supplier. We've seen this big shift in supermarkets over the last sort of decade in terms of customer behavior. It used to be that families would do this once a week, big family shop. Now we're very much in a new world of doing several mini top-up shops throughout the week. So that's really strengthened the sort of need for convenience stores in attractive locations. And that's exactly what McColl's provides Morrisons with. And, you know, McColl actually didn't do too badly during the pandemic because of its convenience stores. So everyone was just popping to the local shop. But more recently, it's really been struggling with problems updating its food range and also problems with post-pandemic supply chain issues. And of course, the problem that we know so many businesses are dealing with right now, which is cost inflation. So unfortunately, all of those pressures meant that McColl's share price was really, really struggling, down by more than 95% year to date before trading was suspended on Friday. So now Morrisons, which beat EG Group, the owner of Asda, to the deal, said it's going to pay off all of its debts, about £170 million worth, and it's going to keep those shops, keep the jobs, and look after the pension scheme too.
Yeah, and I'm presumingly hoping that their sheer scale will alleviate some of those issues that McColl's had, right? Because whenever you take over a business that's effectively collapsed, you should probably ask yourself before you buy it why it collapsed. And it seems like Morrisons feel like they've got the remedy to some of those ills. So we'll wait and see. Let's just talk about something a little cheerier at the end of this, because we don't often talk about anything too cheery on this podcast, especially at the moment. We touched on it in the intro, but Heathrow upgrading its full year forecasts. Not the only airport to deliver good news in recent weeks. It seems like the aviation industry is starting ish to find its feet. The question, I guess, is how does the cost of living crisis bite into that in the second half of the year?
Yeah, and I think that ish is the key phrase there, because it's quite a sort of mixed report when we scratch the surfaces on Heathrow. But the sort of headline is that it's raised its full year passenger forecast. So it's now looking at seeing about 53 million passengers pass through this year, and that's a 16% increase from its previous forecasts. But the big caveat is that it came with lots of warnings. It's saying it's concerned about the war in Ukraine, higher fuel costs, and some restrictions in some of its key markets, like in the US. And all of this is creating an air of uncertainty. Now, it's clear that travel demand is picking up, but it still remains subdued. You know, lots of industries are attempting or have managed to get back up to pre-pandemic levels. But this is a sector that's still struggling. It's looking at travel demand to come in at about 65% of pre-COVID levels this year. And part of that is because of structural shifts that we've seen during the pandemic. You know, we're doing this call right now on Zoom, and a lot of meetings take place on Zoom or on Skype. And so that's had a massive impact for business travel, which may not ever go back to its levels that we saw before. Clearly, 2020 and 2021 was unprecedentedly challenging for the whole sector. And this was meant to be the big recovery year, all of us getting back and traveling abroad. But we've got the cost of living crisis to deal with, the war in Ukraine, and cost inflation too. So unfortunately, Heathrow is forecasting another loss-making year. So it's likely that its first post-pandemic period of profitability is going to be pushed down the line.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary hit. And I think one of the things that we're thinking about in the office in terms of where we cover aviation and where it's going is actually, you know, with those pressures you indicated around fuel, around inflation, also with the inflation of passenger fees, right? As a result of the need for these airports to recover, is whether that era, that halcyon era of real low-cost travel and companies competing at really low margins may well be over. But we shall wait and see. Victoria, always a pleasure to have you join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me back.
And that's all from us at City View today. We'll be back tomorrow with more corporate and economic news. But for now, all from me at City AM Towers.